not blame him for the problems in Iraq. The final question to resolve was the size of the surge. Some in the military proposed that we commit 2 additional brigades initially, a mini-surge of about 10,000 troops, with the possibility of sending up to 3 more brigades later. Pete Pace reported that General Petraeus and General Ray Ordiano, the number 2 commander in Iraq, wanted all 5 brigades committed up front. If our commanders on the ground wanted the full force, they would get it. I decided to send 5 brigades to Baghdad, plus 2 additional Marine battalions to Anbar province. We would embed our troops in Iraqi formations so that we could mentor the Iraqis on the battlefield and prepare the Iraqis to take more responsibility after the surge. Finally, I would accept 3 key recommendations from the Joint Chiefs. Condi would lead a surge in civilian resources. I would obtain public assurances from Prime Minister Maliki about our troops' freedom to maneuver. And I would call on Congress to increase the size of the Army and Marine Corps by 90,000 forces. On January 4, 2007, I held a secure video conference with Maliki. "A lot of people here don't think we can succeed. I do," I told him. "I'll put my neck out if you put out yours." 2 days later, he addressed the Iraqi people and signaled his commitment to the surge. "The Baghdad security plan will not provide a safe haven for any outlaws, regardless of sectarian or political affiliation," he said. The decision had been tough, but I was confident that I had made it the right way. I had gathered facts and opinions from people inside and outside the administration. I had challenged assumptions and weighed all the options carefully. I knew the surge would be unpopular in the short term. But while many in Washington had given up on the prospect of victory in Iraq, I had not. At 9 o'clock on the evening of January 10, 2007, I stepped before the cameras in the White House library. "The situation in Iraq is unacceptable to the American people, and it is unacceptable to me," I said. "Our troops in Iraq have fought bravely. They have done everything we have asked them to do. Where mistakes have been made, the responsibility rests with me. It is clear that we need to change our strategy in Iraq. So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq. The vast majority of them, 5 brigades, will be deployed to Baghdad." The reaction was swift and one-sided. "I don't believe an expansion of 20,000 troops in Iraq will solve the problems," one senator said. "I do not believe that sending more troops to Iraq is the answer," said another. A third pronounced it the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam. And those were just the Republicans. The left was even more outspoken. One freshman senator predicted that the surge would not solve the sectarian violence there. "In fact, I think it will do the reverse." Capturing the view of most of his colleagues, a Washington Post columnist called it a fantasy-based escalation of the war in Iraq, which could only make sense in some parallel universe where pigs fly and fish commute on bicycles. Condi, Bob Gates, and Pete Pace testified on Capitol Hill the day after I announced the surge. The questioning was brutal from both sides of the aisle. "This is the craziest, dumbest plan I've ever seen or heard of in my life," one Democratic congressman told General Pace. "I've gone along with the president on this, and I bought into his dream," a Republican senator told Condi. "At this stage of the game, I just don't think it's going to happen." Afterward, Condi came to see me in the Oval Office. "We've got a tough sell on this, Mr. President," she said. Amid the near universal skepticism, a few brave souls defended the surge. Foremost among them were Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, a lifelong Democrat who had been cast aside by his party for supporting the war. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a member of the Air Force Reserves, and Senator John McCain of Arizona. McCain and I had a complex relationship. We had competed against each other in 2000, and we had disagreed on issues from tax cuts to Medicare reform to terrorist interrogation. Yet he had campaigned hard for me in 2004, and I knew he planned to run for president in 2008. The surge gave him a chance to create distance between us, but he didn't take it. He had been a longtime advocate of more troops in Iraq, and he supported the new strategy wholeheartedly. "I cannot guarantee success," he said, "but I can guarantee failure if we don't adopt this new strategy." The most persuasive advocate of the surge was General Petraeus. As the author of the Army's Counterinsurgency Manual, he was the undisputed authority on the strategy he would lead. His intellect, competitiveness, and work ethic were well known. On one of his visits home, I invited the general to mountain bike with me at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. He was mainly a runner, but he had enough confidence to accept the challenge. He held his own with the experienced riders of the presidential peloton. After the ride, I stepped inside a building at Fort Belvoir to take a call from the Prime Minister of Japan. I heard a noise in the background. I peeked out the door and saw Petraeus leading the peloton through a series of post-ride push-ups and crunches. Petraeus's rise had attracted some resentment. I had heard gossip from several people warning that he had an outsized ego. Back in 2004, when Petraeus was leading the effort to train Iraqi security forces, Newsweek had run a cover with a close-up photo of him above the headline, "Can This Man Save Iraq?" When I raised the topic with him, he smiled and said, "My classmates from West Point are never going to let me live that down." I appreciated his self-deprecating remark. It was a good compliment to his drive. Petraeus's confirmation hearings came late in January. "I think that at this point in Baghdad, the population just wants to be secure," he said. "And truthfully, they don't care who does it." When John McCain pressed him on whether the mission could succeed without more troops, General Petraeus answered, "No, sir." The Senate confirmed him 81-0. I called the general to the Oval Office to congratulate him on the vote. Dick Cheney, Bob Gates, Pete Pace, and other members of the National Security Team were there to wish him well. "I'd like a moment alone with my commander," I said. As the team filed out, I assured General Petraeus that I had confidence in him and that he could have my ear any time. At the end of the meeting, I said, "This is it. We're doubling down." As he walked out the door, he replied, "Mr. President, I think it's more like all in." On February 10, 2007, David Petraeus took command in Baghdad. His task was as daunting as any American commander had faced in decades. As he told his troops on his first day, "The situation in Iraq is exceedingly challenging. The stakes are very high. The way ahead will be hard, and there undoubtedly will be many tough days." He continued, "However, hard is not hopeless. These tasks are achievable. This mission is doable." As our surge troops flowed into Iraq, Generals Petraeus and Odierno relocated our forces from bases on the outskirts of Baghdad to small outposts inside the city. Our troops lived alongside Iraqi security forces and patrolled the city on foot instead of inside armored Humvees. As they entered enemy strongholds for the first time, the extremists fought back. We lost 81 troops in February, 81 in March, 104 in April, 126 in May, and 101 in June. The first time in the war we had faced triple-digit losses 3 months in a row. The casualties were agonizing. But something felt different in 2007. America was on offense again. General Petraeus drew my attention to an interesting metric of progress, the number of intelligence tips from Iraqi residents. In the past, Iraqis had feared retribution from insurgents or death squads for cooperating with our forces. But as security improved, the number of tips grew from about 12,500 in February to almost 25,000 in May. Our troops and intelligence operators used the tips to take insurgents and weapons off the street. The counterinsurgency strategy was working. We were winning over the people by providing what they needed most, security. We followed up the clearing and holding with building, thanks in large part to the civilian surge led by Ambassador Ryan Crocker. I first met Ryan in Pakistan, where he was serving as ambassador during my visit in 2006. He came across as a patient, unassuming diplomat. But beneath his calm exterior was a fearless man, widely regarded as the best Foreign Service officer of his generation. Fluent in Arabic, Ryan had served all over the Middle East, including several tours in Iraq. He had survived the 1983 terrorist attack on our embassy in Lebanon and escaped an angry mob plundering his residence in Syria. When I announced the new strategy in Iraq, I decided we should change ambassadors, too. I nominated Zal Khalizad, who had done a fine job in Baghdad, to be our permanent representative to the UN. Condi didn't take long to recommend a replacement for him. She said Ryan was the only man for the job. Ryan gained my respect quickly. He had a knack for detecting problems and heading them off. He spoke bluntly about challenges, but had a wry sense of humor and liked to laugh. "What have you got for me today, sunshine?" I asked him during one particularly rough stretch. He started his briefing with a big grin. He worked seamlessly with General Petraeus, and he earned the trust of Iraqis from all factions. The heart of the civilian surge was doubling the number of provincial reconstruction teams, which paired civilian experts with military personnel. I held several video conferences and meetings with PRT team leaders deployed across Iraq. They were an impressive group. Several were grizzled combat veterans. Another was a female Foreign Service officer whose son served as a Marine in Iraq. They described their projects, which ranged from supporting a local newspaper in Baghdad to helping set up courts in Nineveh to creating a soil testing laboratory to improve agriculture in Diyala. It wasn't always glamorous work, but it was critical to the counterinsurgency strategy we were carrying out. I spoke to General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker by secure video conference at least once a week, sometimes more often. I believed a close personal relationship and frequent contact were critical to making the new strategy succeed. The conversations gave me a chance to hear first-hand reports on conditions in Iraq. They allowed Petraeus and Crocker to share frustrations and push for decisions directly from the commander-in-chief. The situation was improving, but we all worried about the possibility of another Samarra-like bombing, a game-changer that would reignite sectarian violence. Petraeus pinpointed another problem. "The Washington clock is ticking a lot faster than the Baghdad clock," he said. He was right. Less than 1 week after General Petraeus arrived in Iraq, the new Democratic majority in the House of Representatives had passed the non-binding resolution that declared, "Congress disapproves of the decision of President George W. Bush announced on January 10, 2007, to deploy more than 20,000 additional United States combat troops to Iraq." After a day of heavy violence in April, Senator Harry Reid of Nevada declared, "This war is lost. The surge is not accomplishing anything." The majority leader of the U.S. Senate had just used his platform to tell 145,000 American troops and their families that they were fighting for a lost cause. He had written off the surge as a failure before all of the additional troops had even arrived. It was one of the most irresponsible acts I witnessed in my 8 years in Washington. On May 1st, Congress sent me a war funding bill mandating a troop withdrawal deadline later in the year. Setting an arbitrary pullout date would allow our enemies to wait us out and would undermine our ability to win over the local leaders who were critical to our success. I vetoed the bill. Led by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who supported the surge after I announced it and graciously later admitted to me that he had been wrong to suggest a withdrawal, and House Minority Leader John Boehner, Republicans on Capitol Hill stood firm. Democrats didn't have the votes to override the veto. On May 25th, I signed a bill fully funding our troops with no timetable for withdrawal. They called it the Awakening. Anbar is Iraq's largest province, a sprawling expanse of desert that extends from the western boundary of Baghdad to the borders of Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. At 53,000 square miles, Anbar covers nearly the same amount of land as New York State. Its population is mostly Sunni. For almost 4 years, it served as a stronghold for insurgents and a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda took over Anbar's principal cities, infiltrated the security forces, and imposed their ideology on the population. Like the Taliban, they forbade women from leaving their homes without a male escort and banned sports and other leisure activities. They attacked American troops, Iraqi security forces, and anyone else who resisted them. By 2006, Anbar was home to an average of 41 attacks per day. Our troops discovered an Al-Qaeda document laying out an elaborate governing structure for Anbar, including an education department, social services department, and an execution unit. Our intelligence community believed Anbar was to be Al-Qaeda's base for planning attacks on the United States. In August 2006, a senior Marine Corps intelligence officer in Anbar wrote a widely publicized report concluding that the province was lost. Then everything changed. The people of Anbar had a look at life under Al-Qaeda, and they didn't like what they saw. Starting in mid-2006, tribal sheikhs banded together to take their province back from the extremists. The awakening drew thousands of recruits. As part of the surge, we deployed 4,000 additional Marines to Anbar, where they reinforced the tribal sheikhs and boosted their confidence. Many of the Al-Qaeda jihadists fled into the desert. Violence in the province plummeted by more than 90%. Within months, the brave people of Anbar, with support from our troops, had retaken their province. An Al-Qaeda safe haven had become the site of its greatest ideological defeat. On Labor Day 2007, I made a surprise visit to Anbar. Air Force One flew over what looked like a giant sand dune and touched down at Al-Asad Air Base, a patch of black asphalt amid miles of brown. We walked down the stairs into the searing heat and quickly moved to an air-conditioned room at the base. I listened to several briefings and then met with a group of tribal sheikhs who had started the Anbar uprising. They were a rough-hewn, earthy bunch. Their friendly, animated mannerisms reminded me of local officials in West Texas, but instead of jeans and boots, they were wearing full-length robes and colorful headdresses. The sheikhs beamed with pride as they described what they had accomplished. Violence was down dramatically. Mayor's offices and city councils were functioning. Judges were hearing cases and meeting out justice. With the help of our civilian surge, the provincial council in Ramadi had reopened, with 35 members present for the inaugural session. Prime Minister Maliki and President Jalal Talabani joined the meeting. It was extraordinary to watch Maliki, a Shia, Talabani, a Kurd, and a room full of Sunni sheikhs discuss the future of their country. When the prime minister asked what they needed, they had a long list of requests: more money, more equipment, and more infrastructure. Maliki complained that there wasn't enough in the budget for everything they asked for. Talabani helped referee the disputes. I sat back and enjoyed the scene. Democracy was at work in Iraq. I thank the sheikhs for their hospitality and their bravery in the war on terror. "If you need us," one sheikh jubilantly told me, "my men and I will go to Afghanistan." Washington was abuzz when Petraeus and Crocker arrived on September 10th to testify before Congress and make recommendations on the way forward in Iraq. For months, Democrats had pledged to use their testimony to cut off funding for the war. In July, the New York Times declared the cause in Iraq lost and called for an all-out withdrawal, despite the likelihood that an immediate pullout could result in further ethnic cleansing, even genocide, and a new stronghold from which terrorist activity could proliferate. It was stunning to see the Times, which rightly championed human rights, advocate a policy it admitted could lead to genocide. The morning of the hearings, the left-wing group MoveOn.org ran a full-page newspaper ad that read, "General Petraeus, or General Betrayas, cooking the books for the White House." It was an astonishing character attack on a four-star general. It was also a political mistake. Democrats in Congress tried to avoid endorsing the ad while supporting the anti-war sentiment behind it. One New York senator denounced the ad, but said Petraeus' report required the willing suspension of disbelief. For their part, Petraeus and Crocker were stoic, resilient, and highly credible. They reported the facts. Iraqi civilian deaths had declined 70% in Baghdad and 45% across the country. Deaths from sectarian violence had plunged 80% in Baghdad and 55% across the country. IED attacks had dropped by a third, and car bombings and suicide attacks had declined almost 50%. The awakening movement we had witnessed in Anbar had spread to Diyala province and the Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad. The picture was unmistakable. The surge was working. Two nights after the testimony, I spoke to the nation. Because of this success, General Petraeus believes we have now reached the point where we can maintain our security gains with fewer American forces, I said. The principle guiding my decisions on troop levels in Iraq is return on success. The more successful we are, the more American troops can return home. The most quoted phrase in the speech was, return on success. The clever play on words was suggested by Ed Gillespie, a smart and valued friend who agreed to lead my communications team when Dan Bartlett returned home to Texas. But in my mind, the most important message was that we were keeping as many troops in Iraq as our commanders needed, for as long as they needed them. The day of my speech, I heard that General Petraeus' friend, retired General Jack Keane, was meeting with Dick Cheney. I liked and respected Jack. He had provided valuable advice during the decision-making process and supported the surge publicly. I asked Jack to convey a personal message from me to General Petraeus. I waited over 3 years for a successful strategy, and I'm not giving up on it prematurely. I am not reducing further unless you are convinced that we should reduce further. 3 weeks after the much-awaited testimony, I rode to the military parade grounds at Fort Myer, Virginia, to say farewell to a friend. Shortly after I announced the surge, Bob Gates had recommended that I not renominate General Pete Pace to a second term as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The environment on Capitol Hill was hostile, and Bob had heard from several senators, especially Carl Levin, the new chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, that Pete's confirmation hearing would be contentious. The concern was that senators would use him as a punching bag for all their frustrations with Iraq. I admired Pete. I had benefited from his advice for 6 years. I knew how much our troops loved him. I wanted to end the presidency with my friend as chairman, but I pictured the spectacle of the hearing, protesters yelling and senators preening for the cameras, all ending with a negative vote that would humiliate Pete. I reluctantly agreed with Bob's judgment. I nominated Mike Mullen, a fine Navy admiral, to be the next chairman. Pete never complained. He served nobly to the end. After turning over his duties, he removed the 4 stars from his uniform, pinned them to a note card, and left it at the foot of the Vietnam Memorial near the name of a Marine lost 4 decades earlier. He brought no cameras or press. Later the card was found at the foot of the wall. It read, "To Guido Farinaro, USMC, these stars are yours, not mine. With love and respect, your platoon leader, Pete Pace." I ached for Pete and his family. When I presented him with a well-deserved Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2008, it only partly assuaged my regret. The momentum of the surge continued into 2008. By spring, more than 90,000 Iraqis, both Sunni and Shia, had joined concerned local citizens groups like those that had started at Anbar. Many of these forces, now known as Sons of Iraq, integrated into the increasingly effective army and police force, which had grown to more than 475,000. They drove the remaining hardcore insurgents and Al-Qaeda from their strongholds. The terrorists resorted to using children and the mentally handicapped as suicide bombers, revealing both their moral depravity and their inability to recruit. Just as counterinsurgency experts predicted, The security gains of 2007 translated into political progress in 2008. Free from the nightmare of sectarian violence, the Iraqis passed a flurry of major legislation, including a law resolving the status of former Ba'ath Party members, a national budget, and legislation paving the way for provincial elections. While the government still had work to do on some key measures, including an oil revenue sharing law, the Iraqis' political performance was a remarkable feat, given all that they had endured. The biggest concern in the spring of 2008 was the presence of Shia extremists. While security in most of Iraq improved during the surge, Shia extremists, many with close ties to Iran, had taken over large parts of Basra, Iraq's second largest city. On March 25, 2008, Iraqi forces attacked the extremists in Basra. Prime Minister Maliki traveled to the south to oversee the operation. Most of my national security team was somewhere between anxious and petrified. The military worried that Maliki did not have a well-defined plan. Some in the embassy questioned whether he had enough support within the Iraqi government. The CIA gave Maliki's assault a bleak prognosis. I felt differently. Maliki was leading. For almost 2 years, I had urged him to show his even-handedness. A Shia murderer is as guilty as a Sunni murderer, I said many times. Now, he had followed through in a highly public way. When Steve Hadley and Brett McGurk came to the Oval Office the morning after Maliki launched the attack, I said, "Don't tell me this is a bad thing. Maliki said he would do this, and now he's doing it. This is a defining moment. We just need to help him succeed." The assault was far from textbook, but it worked. The Iraqi forces brought security to Basra. Their success stunned Shia radicals like Muqtada al-Sadr and their backers in Iran. Above all, the Basra operation established Maliki as a strong leader. The prime minister had reached a major decision point of his own, and he had made the right call. A few weeks after the Iraqi government's offensive in Basra, Petraeus and Crocker returned to Washington to testify in April. This time, there were no anti-war ads in the newspapers and no prolonged battle for funding. NBC News, which in November 2006 had officially pronounced Iraq in a state of civil war, stopped using the term. There was no grand announcement of the retraction. Calling our gains in Iraq fragile and reversible, General Petraeus recommended that we continue withdrawing troops until we hit pre-surge levels, and then pause for further assessment. As Ryan Crocker put it, "In the end, how we leave Iraq and what we leave behind will be more important than how we came. Our current course is hard, but it is working. We need to stay with it." I agreed. It was a measure of the surge's success that one of the biggest military controversies of early 2008 did not involve Iraq. In March, Admiral Fox Fallon, who had succeeded John Abizaid as commander of CENTCOM, gave a magazine interview suggesting he was the only person standing between me and war with Iran. That was ridiculous. I asked Joint Chiefs Chairman Mike Mullen and Vice Chairman Hoss Cartwright what they would do if they were in Fallon's position. Both said they would resign. Soon after, Fox submitted his resignation. To his credit, he never brought up the issue again. At our last meeting, I thanked him for his service and told him I was proud of his fine career. I had to find a new commander to lead CENTCOM. There was only one person I wanted, David Petraeus. He had spent 3 of the past 4 years in Iraq, and I knew he was hoping to assume the coveted NATO command in Europe. But we needed him at CENTCOM. "If the 22-year-old kids can stay in the fight," he said, "I can too." I asked General Petraeus who should replace him in Iraq. Without hesitation, he named his former deputy commander, General Ray Odierno. I first met Ray years earlier when I toured Fort Hood as governor of Texas. 6'5", with a clean-shaven head, the general is an imposing man. He was an early proponent of the surge, and he helped the strategy succeed by positioning the additional troops wisely throughout Baghdad. For General Odierno, Winning in Iraq was more than his duty as a soldier. It was personal. When Ray was home on leave in December 2004, I welcomed his family to the Oval Office, including his son, Lieutenant Anthony Odierno, a West Point graduate who had lost his left arm in Iraq. His father stood silently, beaming with pride, as his son raised his right arm to salute me. Even though Ray had just left for a top position back home at the Pentagon, he accepted the call to return as commander in Baghdad. It gave me solace to know that the next president would be able to rely on the advice of these two wise, battle-tested generals. In our own way, we had continued one of the great traditions of American history. Lincoln discovered Generals Grant and Sherman. Roosevelt had Eisenhower and Bradley. I found David Petraeus and Ray Odierno. By the time the surge ended in the summer of 2008, violence in Iraq had dropped to the lowest level since the first year of the war. The sectarian killing that had almost ripped the country apart in 2006 was down more than 95%. Prime Minister Maliki, once the object of near universal blame and scorn, had emerged as a confident leader. Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been severely weakened and marginalized. Iran's malign influence had been reduced. Iraqi forces were preparing to take responsibility for security in a majority of provinces. American deaths, which routinely hit 100 a month in the worst stretch of the war, never again topped 25, and dropped to single digits by the end of my presidency. Nevertheless, every death was a painful reminder of the costs of war. My last major goal was to put Iraq policy onto a stable footing for my successors. In late 2007, we started work on two agreements. One, called a Status of Forces Agreement, SOFA, laid the legal predicate for keeping American troops in Iraq after the United Nations mandate expired at the end of 2008. The other, called a Strategic Framework Agreement, SFA, pledged long-term diplomatic, economic, and security cooperation between our countries. Hammering out the agreements took months. Maliki had to deal with serious opposition from factions of his government, especially those with suspected ties to Iran. In the middle of a presidential campaign, Democratic candidates denounced the SOFA as a scheme to keep our troops in Iraq forever. The CIA doubted that Maliki would sign the agreement. I asked the Prime Minister about it directly. He assured me he wanted the SOFA. He had kept his word in the past, and I believed he would again. Maliki proved a tough negotiator. He would obtain a concession from our side, and then come back asking for more. On one level, the endless horse trading was frustrating. But on another level, I was inspired to see the Iraqis conducting themselves like representatives of a sovereign democracy. As time passed without agreement, I started to get anxious. In one of our weekly video conferences, I said, "Mr. Prime Minister, I only have a few months left in office. I need to know whether you want these agreements. If not, I have better things to do." I could tell he was a little taken aback. This was my signal that it was time to stop asking for more. "We will finish these agreements," he said. "You have my word." By November, the agreements were almost done. The final contentious issue was what the SOFA would say about America's withdrawal from Iraq. Maliki told us it would help him if the agreement included a promise to pull out our troops by a certain date. Our negotiators settled on a commitment to withdraw our forces by the end of 2011. For years, I had refused to set an arbitrary timetable for leaving Iraq. I was still hesitant to commit to a date, but this was not arbitrary. The agreement had been negotiated between two sovereign governments, and it had the blessing of Generals Petraeus and Odierno, who would oversee its implementation. If conditions changed and Iraqis requested a continued American presence, we could amend the SOFA and keep troops in the country. Maliki's political instincts proved wise. The SOFA and SFA, initially seen as documents focused on our staying in Iraq, ended up being viewed as agreements paving the way for our departure. The blowback we initially feared from Capitol Hill and the Iraqi parliament never materialized. As I write in 2010, the sofa continues to guide our presence in Iraq. On December 13, 2008, I boarded Air Force One for my fourth trip to Iraq, where I would sign the SOFA, an SFA, with Prime Minister Maliki. On the flight over, I thought about my previous trips to the country. They traced the arc of the war. There was the joy of the first visit on Thanksgiving Day 2003, which came months after liberation and a few weeks before the capture of Saddam. There was the uncertainty of the trip to meet Maliki in June 2006, when sectarian violence was rising and our strategy was failing. There was the cautious optimism of Anbar in September 2007, when the surge appeared to be working but still faced serious opposition. Now there was this final journey. Even though much of America seemed to have tuned out the war, our troops and the Iraqis had created the prospect of lasting success. We landed in Baghdad and choppered to Salam Palace, which 6 years earlier had belonged to Saddam and his brutal regime. As president, I had attended many arrival ceremonies. None was more moving than standing in the courtyard of that liberated palace, next to President Jalal Talabani, watching the flags of the United States and of Free Iraq fly side by side as a military band played our national anthems. From there we drove to the Prime Minister's complex, where Maliki and I signed the SOFA and the SFA and held a final press conference. The room was packed tight, and the audience was closer than at a normal event. A handful of Iraqi journalists sat in front of me on the left. To my right was the traveling press pool and a few reporters based in Iraq. As Maliki called for the first question, a man in the Iraqi press rose abruptly. He let out what sounded like a loud bark, something in Arabic that sure wasn't a question. Then he wound up and threw something in my direction. What was it? A shoe? The scene went into slow motion. I felt like Ted Williams, who said he could see the stitching of a baseball on an incoming pitch. The wingtip was helicoptering toward me. I ducked. The guy had a pretty live arm. A split second later, he threw another one. This one was not flying as fast. I flicked my head slightly and it drifted over me. I wish I had caught the damn thing. Chaos erupted. People screamed, and security agents scrambled. I had the same thought I'd had in the Florida classroom on 9/11. I knew my reaction would be broadcast around the world. The bigger the frenzy, the better for the attacker. I waved off Don White, my lead Secret Service agent. I did not want footage of me being hustled out of the room. I glanced at Maliki, who looked stricken. The Iraqi reporters were humiliated and angry. One man was shaking his head sadly, mouthing apologies. I held up my hands and urged everyone to settle down. "If you want the facts, it's a size 10 shoe that he threw," I said. I hoped that by trivializing the moment, I could keep the shoe thrower from accomplishing his goal of ruining the event. After the press conference, Maliki and I went to a dinner upstairs with our delegations. He was still shaken and apologized profusely. I took him aside privately with Gamal Halal, our Arabic interpreter, and told him to stop worrying. The Prime Minister gathered himself and asked to speak before the dinner. He gave an emotional toast about how the shoe thrower did not represent his people, and how grateful his nation was to America. He talked about how we had given them two chances to be free, first by liberating them from Saddam Hussein, and again by helping them liberate themselves from the sectarian violence and terrorists. Having a shoe thrown at me by a journalist ranked as one of my more unusual experiences. But what if someone had said 8 years earlier that the President of the United States would be dining in Baghdad with the Prime Minister of a free Iraq? Nothing, not even flying footwear at a press conference, would have seemed more unlikely than that. Years from now, historians may look back and see the surge as a foregone conclusion, an inevitable bridge between the years of violence that followed liberation and the democracy that emerged. Nothing about the surge felt inevitable at the time. Public opinion ran strongly against it. Congress tried to block it. The enemy fought relentlessly to break our will. Yet thanks to the skill and courage of our troops, the new counterinsurgency strategy we adopted, the superb coordination between our civilian and military efforts, and the strong support we provided for Iraq's political leaders, a war widely written off as a failure has a chance to end in success. By the time I left office, the violence had declined dramatically. Economic and political activity had resumed. Al-Qaeda had suffered a significant military and ideological defeat. In March 2010, Iraqis went to the polls again. In a headline unimaginable 3 years earlier, Newsweek ran a cover story titled, "Victory at Last, the Emergence of a Democratic Iraq." Iraq still faces challenges, and no one can know with certainty what the fate of the country will be. But we do know this. Because the United States liberated Iraq and then refused to abandon it, the people of that country have a chance to be free. Having come this far, I hope America will continue to support Iraq's young democracy. If Iraqis request a continued troop presence, we should provide it. A free and peaceful Iraq is in our vital strategic interest. It can be a valuable ally at the heart of the Middle East, a source of stability in the region, and a beacon of hope to political reformers in its neighborhood and around the world. Like the democracies we helped build in Germany, Japan, and South Korea, a free Iraq will make us safer for generations to come. I have often reflected on whether I should have ordered the surge earlier. For 3 years, our premise in Iraq was that political progress was the measure of success. The Iraqis hit all their milestones on time. It looked like our strategy was working. Only after the sectarian violence erupted in 2006 did it become clear that more security was needed before political progress could continue. After that, I moved forward with the surge in a way that unified our government. If I had acted sooner, it could have created a rift that would have been exploited by war critics in Congress to cut off funding and prevent the surge from succeeding. From the beginning of the war in Iraq, my conviction was that freedom is universal, and democracy in the Middle East would make the region more peaceful. There were times when that seemed unlikely, but I never lost faith that it was true. I never lost faith in our troops, either. I was constantly amazed by their willingness to volunteer in the face of danger. In August 2007, I traveled to Reno, Nevada, to speak to the American Legion. Afterward, I met Bill and Christine Krissoff from Truckee, California. Their son, 25-year-old Marine Nathan Krissoff, had given his life in Iraq. His brother Austin, also a Marine, was at the meeting. Austin and Christine told me how much Nathan loved his job. Then Bill spoke up. "Mr. President, I'm an orthopedic surgeon," he said. "I want to join the Navy Medical Corps in Nathan's honor." I was moved and surprised. "How old are you?" I asked. "I'm 60, sir," he replied. I was 61, so 60 didn't sound that old to me. I looked at his wife. She nodded. Bill explained that he was willing to retire from his orthopedic practice in California, but he needed a special age waiver to qualify for the Navy. "I'll see what I can do," I said. When I got back to Washington, I told Pete Pace the story after a morning briefing. Before long, Dr. Krissoff's waiver came through. He underwent extensive training in battlefield medicine. Shortly after I left office, he deployed to Iraq, where he served alongside Austin and treated wounded Marines. "I like to think that Austin and I are completing Nate's unfinished task here in Iraq," he wrote. "We honor his memory by our work here." In 2010, I learned that Dr. Krissoff had returned home from Iraq and then shipped off to Afghanistan. Nathan Krissoff is one of the 4,229 American service members who gave their lives in Iraq during my presidency. More than 30,000 suffered wounds of war. I will always carry with me the grief their families feel. I will never forget the pride they took in their work, the inspiration they brought to others, and the difference they made in the world. Every American who served in Iraq helped to make our nation safer gave 25 million people the chance to live in freedom and change the direction of the Middle East for generations to come. There are things we got wrong in Iraq, but that cause is eternally right. Chapter 13, Freedom Agenda. Just before noon on January 20th, 2005, I stepped onto the inaugural platform. From the west front of the Capitol, I looked out on the crowd of 400,000 that stretched back across the National Mall. Behind them, I could see the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and Arlington National Cemetery on the other side of the Potomac. The 2005 inauguration marked the third time I had admired that view. In 1989, I was a proud son watching his dad get sworn in. In 2001, I took the presidential oath under freezing rain and the clouds of a disputed election. I had to concentrate on each step down the Capitol stairs, which were a lot narrower than I'd expected. It took time for my senses to adjust to the flurry of sounds and sights. I stared out at the huge, huddled mass of black and gray overcoats. I wondered if the sleet would make it hard to see the teleprompter when I gave my inaugural address. 4 years later, the sky was sunny and clear. The colors seemed more vibrant, and the election results had been decisive. As I walked down the blue-carpeted steps toward the stage, I was able to pick out individual faces in the crowd. I saw Joe and Jan O'Neill, along with a large contingent from Midland. I smiled at the dear friends who had introduced me to the wonderful woman at my side. One thing was for sure. As we enjoyed our burgers that night in 1977, none of us expected this. I took my seat in the row ahead of Laura, Barbara, and Jenna. Mother and Dad, Laura's mom, and my brothers and sisters sat nearby. Senator Trent Lott, the chairman of the inaugural committee, called Chief Justice William Rehnquist to the podium. I stepped forward with Laura, Barbara, and Jenna. Laura held the Bible, which both Dad and I had used to take the oath. It was open to Isaiah 40:31. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. I put my left hand on the Bible and raised my right as the ailing Chief Justice administered the 35-word oath. When I closed with, "So help me God," the cannons boomed a 21-gun salute. I hugged Laura and the girls, stepped back, and soaked in the moment. Then it was time for the speech. At this second gathering, our duties are defined not by the words I use, but by the history we have seen together. For a half century, America defended our own freedom by standing watch on distant borders. After the shipwreck of communism came years of relative quiet, years of repose, years of sabbatical, and then there came a day of fire. We have seen our vulnerability, and we have seen its deepest source. For as long as whole regions of the world simmer in resentment and tyranny, prone to ideologies that feed hatred and excuse murder, violence will gather and multiply in destructive power and cross the most defended borders and raise a mortal threat. There's only one force of history that can break the reign of hatred and resentment and expose the pretensions of tyrants and reward the hopes of the decent and tolerant, and that is the force of human freedom. We are led by events and common sense to one conclusion. The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world. So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. After 9/11, I developed a strategy to protect the country that came to be known as the Bush Doctrine. First, make no distinction between the terrorists and the nations that harbor them, and hold both to account. Second, Take the fight to the enemy overseas before they can attack us again here at home. Third, confront threats before they fully materialize. And fourth, advance liberty and hope as an alternative to the enemy's ideology of repression and fear. The freedom agenda, as I called the fourth prong, was both idealistic and realistic. It was idealistic in that freedom is a universal gift from Almighty God. It was realistic because freedom is the most practical way to protect our country in the long run. As I said in my second inaugural address, America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. The transformative power of freedom had been proven in places like South Korea, Germany, and Eastern Europe. For me, the most vivid example of freedom's power was my relationship with Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi of Japan. Koizumi was one of the first world leaders to offer his support after 9/11. How ironic. 60 years earlier, my father had fought the Japanese as a Navy pilot. Koizumi's father had served in the government of Imperial Japan. Now, their sons were working together to keep the peace. Something big had changed since World War II. By adopting a Japanese-style democracy, an enemy had become an ally. Announcing the freedom agenda was one step. Implementing it was another. In some places, such as Afghanistan and Iraq, we had a unique responsibility to give the people we liberated a chance to build free societies. But these examples were the exception, not the rule. I made clear that the freedom agenda was not primarily the task of arms. We would advance freedom by supporting fledgling democratic governments in places like the Palestinian territories, Lebanon, Georgia, and Ukraine. We would encourage dissidents and democratic reformers suffering under repressive regimes in Iran, Syria, North Korea, and Venezuela. And we would advocate for freedom while maintaining strategic relationships with nations like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Russia, and China. Critics charged that the freedom agenda was a way for America to impose our values on others. But freedom is not an American value. It is a universal value. Freedom cannot be imposed. It must be chosen. And when people are given the choice, they choose freedom. At the end of World War II, there were about 24 democracies in the world. When I took office in January 2001, there were 120. Shortly after the 2004 election, I read The Case for Democracy by Natan Sharansky, a dissident who spent 9 years in the Soviet gulags. In the book, Sharansky describes how he and his fellow prisoners were inspired by hearing leaders like Ronald Reagan speak with moral clarity and call for their freedom. In one memorable passage, Sharansky describes a fellow Soviet dissident who likened a tyrannical state to a soldier who constantly points a gun at a prisoner. Eventually, his arms tire, and the prisoner escapes. I considered it America's responsibility to put pressure on the arms of the world's tyrants. Making that goal a central part of our foreign policy was one of my most consequential decisions as president. The great tide of freedom that swept much of the world during the second half of the 20th century had largely bypassed one region, the Middle East. The UN's Arab Human Development Report, released in 2002, revealed the bleak state of the region. 1 in 3 people was illiterate. Unemployment averaged 15%. Less than 1% of the population had access to the internet. Maternal mortality rates rival those of the least developed countries in the world. Economic output per capita was minuscule. The authors of the UN report, a group of respected Arab scholars, attributed the depressing results to 3 deficits: a deficit in knowledge, a deficit in women's empowerment, and most important, a deficit in freedom. For most of the Cold War, America's priority in the Middle East was stability. Our alliances were based on anti-communism, a strategy that made sense at the time. But under the surface, resentment and anger built. Many people turned to radical clerics and mosques as a release. Amid these conditions, terrorists found fertile recruiting ground. Then, 19 terrorists born in the Middle East turned up on planes in the United States. After 9/11, I decided that the stability we had been promoting was a mirage. The focus of the freedom agenda would be the Middle East. 6 months before I took office, the Camp David peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians fell apart. President Clinton had worked tirelessly to bring together Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Barak made a generous offer to turn over most of the West Bank and Gaza, two territories with majority Palestinian populations that were occupied by Israeli forces and dotted with Israeli settlements. Arafat turned him down. 2 months later, in September 2000, frustration over the failed peace accord, along with prominent Israeli leader Ariel Sharon's provocative visit to Jerusalem's Temple Mount, led to the second Intifada. Palestinian extremists, many affiliated with the terrorist group Hamas, launched a wave of terrorist attacks against innocent civilians in Israel. I didn't blame President Clinton for the failure at Camp David or the violence that followed. I blamed Arafat. America, Europe, and the United Nations had flooded the Palestinian territories with development aid. A good portion of it was diverted to Arafat's bank account. He made the Forbes list of the world's wealthiest kings, queens, and despots. Yet his people remained trapped in poverty, hopelessness, and extremism. For a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, he sure didn't seem very interested in peace. The Israeli people responded to the violent onslaught the way any democracy would. They elected a leader who promised to protect them, Ariel Sharon. I first met Sharon in 1998 when Laura and I went to Israel with three fellow governors on a trip sponsored by the Republican Jewish Coalition. The visit was my first to the Holy Land. The most striking memory of the trip came when Ariel Sharon, then a minister in the cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, gave us a helicopter tour of the country. Sharon was a bull of a man, a 70-year-old former tank commander who had served in all of Israel's wars. Shortly after the chopper lifted off, he pointed to a patch of ground below. "I fought there," he said with pride in his gruff voice. When the helicopter turned toward the West Bank, he gestured at an isolated cluster of homes. "I built that settlement," he said. Sharon subscribed to the Greater Israel policy, which rejected territorial concessions. He knew every inch of the land, and it didn't sound like he intended to give any of it back. "Here our country was only 9 miles wide," Sharon said at another point, referring to the distance between the 1967 borders and the sea. "We have driveways longer than that in Texas," I later joked. I was struck by Israel's vulnerability in a hostile neighborhood. Ever since President Harry Truman defied his Secretary of State by recognizing Israel in 1948, America had been the Jewish state's best friend. I came away convinced that we had a responsibility to keep the relationship strong. A little over 2 years later, I called Ariel Sharon from the Oval Office to congratulate him on his election as Prime Minister. "Maybe, after so many years and wars in which I have participated," he said, "we will have peace in the region." On June 1, 2001, a suicide bomber killed 21 Israelis at the Dolphinarium nightclub in Tel Aviv. Other attacks struck Israeli buses, train stations, and shopping malls. Israeli defense forces targeted operations at Hamas strongholds, but innocent Palestinians, including 5 boys walking to school one day, were killed during the operations. I was appalled by the violence and loss of life on both sides, but I refused to accept the moral equivalence between Palestinian suicide attacks on innocent civilians and Israeli military actions intended to protect their people. My views came into sharper focus after 9/11. If the United States had the right to defend itself and prevent future attacks, other democracies had those rights too. I spoke to Yasser Arafat 3 times in my first year as president. He was courteous, and I was polite in return. But I made clear we expected him to crack down on extremism. I know these are difficult issues for you and your people, I told him in February 2001. But the best way to settle this and start resolving the situation is to stop the violence in the region. In January 2002, the Israeli Navy intercepted a ship called the Karin A in the Red Sea. Aboard was an arsenal of deadly weapons. The Israelis believed the ship was headed from Iran to the Palestinian city of Gaza. Arafat sent a letter pleading his innocence. The smuggling of arms is in total contradiction of the Palestinian Authority's commitment to the peace process, he wrote. But we and the Israelis had evidence that disproved the Palestinian leader's claim. Arafat had lied to me. I never trusted him again. In fact, I never spoke to him again. By the spring of 2002, I had concluded that peace would not be possible with Arafat in power. When will the pig leave Ramallah? Crown Prince Abdullah asked me. It was April 25th, 2002. Clearly, the Saudi ruler was not happy with Ariel Sharon. Ever since President Franklin Roosevelt met with Saudi Arabia's founder, King Abdulaziz, aboard the USS Quincy in 1945, America's relationship with the kingdom had been one of our most critical. The Sunni Arab nation sits on a fifth of the world's oil and has tremendous influence among Muslims as the guardian of the holy mosques at Mecca and Medina. I had invited Crown Prince Abdullah, one of Abdulaziz's 36 sons, to our ranch in Crawford as a way to strengthen our personal relationship. In anticipation of the March 2002 Arab League summit in Beirut, the Crown Prince showed strong leadership by announcing a new peace plan. Under his vision, Israel would return territory to the Palestinians, who would create an independent state that rejected terror and recognized Israel's right to exist. There were many details to negotiate, but the concept was one I could support. The evening of the Arab League summit, a Hamas suicide bomber walked into a hotel dining room filled with people celebrating Passover in the Israeli city of Netanya. Suddenly it was hell, one guest said. There was the smell of smoke and dust in my mouth and a ringing in my ears. One of the bloodiest attacks of the Second Intifada, the bombing killed 30 Israelis and wounded 140. In response, Prime Minister Sharon ordered a sweeping Israeli offensive into the West Bank. Israeli forces quickly picked up hundreds of suspected militants and surrounded Yasser Arafat in his Ramallah office. Sharon announced he would build a security barrier separating Israeli communities from the Palestinians in the West Bank. The fence was widely condemned. I hoped it would provide the security Israelis needed to make hard choices for peace. I urged Sharon privately to end the offensive, which had become counterproductive. Arafat held a TV interview by candlelight and was looking like a martyr. Sharon forged ahead. I gave a Rose Garden speech publicly calling on him to be